This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com. This is part two of a two-part podcast. If you'd like part one, you'll find it at PersonalLifeMedia.com.
My name's Meredith Medland, and you've tuned in to Living Green. You're listening to part two of a two-part series featuring Brent Kessel. Brent Kessel is the author of It's Not About the Money. In part one, we learned about eight financial archetypes. Today, in part two, we're going to learn what it means to be living green. Brent's going to address two particular examples of eco-entrepreneurs. And as you'll see, there's a PDF file attached to this podcast that has three exercises that I think will help both you and me in our financial stability. So here we go. We're going right into part two. Thanks so much for listening to Living Green.
I'd really like to see Congress override President Bush's most recent veto of the stem cell, federal funding for stem cell research. I have a personal relationship to this because my older son has type 1 diabetes, and, you know, we've been delayed in finding a cure by probably 7 years with what this administration's policy has been. And it just, you know, it's just a personal thing, and it doesn't make any sense to me given that there's 400,000 embryos sitting in IVF clinics, and anyone who's infertile can go and create embryos all day long, and everyone knows they're not going to become human life, but you can't use them to save all the lives that are being lost today to Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and diabetes and other diseases. So, it's just infuriating that there's such a philosophical inconsistency that's actually creating suffering. If it's what we really think serves us the best, what we think we have to do in order to survive, we're not just going to stop doing it. And so it's the same with eating meat. I mean, you know, there's many people that feel they really do need the meat and need the protein in order to feel healthy. And whether that's true or not, or whether we just love the taste of it, there's going to be a strong resistance to any sort of move we make in another direction. And so, you know, what I would say is just expect that.
Welcome back. My name is Meredith Medland. We're here with Brent Kessel, and Brent agreed to create three outcomes within the next 3 months. Brent, what would they be?
Just to clarify for me, are these, I came up with sort of three outcomes I'd like to see in the world as, okay. The first one is I'd really like to see Congress override President Bush's most recent veto of the stem cell, federal funding for stem cell research. I have a personal relationship to this because my older son has type 1 diabetes, and, you know, we've been delayed in finding a cure by probably 7 years with what this administration's policy has been. And it just, you know, it's just a personal thing, and it doesn't make any sense to me given that there's 400,000 embryos sitting in IVF clinics, and anyone who's infertile can go and create embryos all day long, and everyone knows they're not going to become human life, but you can't use them to save all the lives that are being lost today to Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and diabetes and other diseases. So, it's just infuriating that there's such a philosophical inconsistency that's actually creating suffering. So I'd love to see that occur and many of the diseases get cured, not in 90 days, but, you know, probably within a few years. The second one is I think we are so close to ending poverty on this planet. What you did with Kiva, with your small loan, is happening in bigger and bigger ways. We were just the largest investment advisor to ever invest in microfinance on a global basis and putting quite a few million dollars into it. And it's happening. There's Silicon Valley venture capitalists that are doing it. There's huge investment banks that are starting to do it. There's literally hundreds of millions of dollars flowing into that space specifically to create self-sufficiency for the world's poor. If I were to predict, I think there won't be poverty on this planet after 2015. And I tend to be fairly idealistic and optimistic, but that's my prediction. And so, you know, in 90 days, I would just love to see, you know, $1 billion flow into microcredit. I think that that's really the wave of the future, is, as opposed to philanthropy. It needs to be combined with philanthropy because there's a lot that microcredit can't do, but microcredit is a tremendous engine to help people. People will help themselves 99% of the time if we give them the tools. And then the last one is I'd love to see the majority of the Western world become vegetarian. I just think there's almost nothing that people can do to have a bigger impact on the environment, I believe, than that one choice, and it's a personal choice. It doesn't require anyone else to do anything. You don't need a different president. You don't need a different Congress. You don't need the oil companies to do something different. But when you look at, you know, the carbon production and all that from factory farming, it's just, it's phenomenal, and the waste runoff into the water system, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Not to mention, you know, the transport of the animals and the transport of the meat and the refrigeration of it. It's just, the environmental cost of it is just staggering. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but, and I think it's a wonderful choice. I mean, I've been veggie for a long time, and I don't think I enjoy food any less than anyone else I know. So those would be my three outcomes.
Thank you for that. So I like this idea of the vegetarianism. And what I'd like you to highlight for us is, what are the beliefs and attitudes that you're holding to make those choices? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think the main belief and attitude really that's behind all three of my outcomes is that we're all interconnected, you know, that all life is really one thing, and animals are no different. That I believe that the consciousness that is aware in a cow or a chicken or a pig as it's heading to slaughter is almost no different than the consciousness that would be in you or me as we were heading to slaughter. The fear, the physiology is almost identical. I mean, they've proven that with science, but it's really, for me, it's random in my mind that I ended up in Brent Kessel's body, that I, this consciousness, happened to be this 6'1" white American, you know, with whatever else is in my life. And I could just as easily have been you. I could just as easily have been a cow. I could just as easily have been a starving kid, you know, in Zimbabwe. And so how do I want to treat the rest of the life form, given that, you know, if you look at it just on a physical plane, I could have been it, you know, this awareness that's in me could have been in those bodies. And if you look at it in a more spiritual way, that I am it. It's not about the physical residence we've taken up for this life. It's about the actual energy that's inside us, and that I really have experienced a real oneness, you know, with other life in that. So stem cell poverty and vegetarianism all just really, in my mind, take a step towards affirming that truth.
When we talked about what your eco request would be for our listeners, you mentioned that one of the things you would really love is to have them take on eating vegetarian at least 6 days a week. So as you go back into reviewing both your own transition around going into vegetarianism, or your friends or other people that you've helped through that process, what are some of the things that you can highlight for our listeners if they'd like to take that on?
Mine was very young, so it's hard to talk about mine, because I, you know, it was just one choice and I never really looked back. But for friends and family members that have made the choice later, you know, I think to know that there will be a strong resistance. And this is true of any change. I mean, if you're an idealist in the archetype system we just talked about, you know, and you want to balance yourself out by having a little more savor in you, or a little more caretaker in you, your idealist is not going to just give up and roll over, because we've created these archetypes unconsciously because it's the most intelligent response to life. It's what serves us the best. And if it's what we really think serves us the best, what we think we have to do in order to survive, we're not just going to stop doing it. And so it's the same with eating meat. I mean, you know, there's many people that feel they really do need the meat and need the protein in order to feel healthy. And whether that's true or not, or whether we just love the taste of it, there's going to be a strong resistance to any sort of move we make in another direction. And so, you know, what I would say is just expect that and engage it in a conversation that is not confrontational. When people try and change financial archetypes, I really encourage a conversation between the sort of inner four-year-old, the unconscious young place inside us that has latched onto these sets of beliefs and strategies to feel safe with money and or feel happy, and the adult wisdom that says, God, I don't need to do that anymore. It's just silly. I don't need a fifth coat in my closet, or I don't need, you know, a nice car. My car is just fine. So that's the adult wisdom. But until we engage the sort of very young, unconscious place, and by engage, I mean open arms, I want to hear what you have to say, really. And so to the meat-eating part, you wanted that example. Like, tell me what you have to say. Tell me what you really feel is helpful, better about me continuing to eat meat, and I'll listen. I want to let you in, you know. And so they come to some kind of agreement where you're really holding both perspectives at one time, not rejecting one.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that. And I would say, of course, being the founder of Three Outcomes, that if you can create three outcomes around your relationship to food and stick them up around you and create them with a positive tone, that you can focus on anything for 3 months and it will become true if you're realistic about it. So I definitely agree with you. We're coming up to the end of our show. And if you could leave a legacy, what would that legacy be?
I have a very strong emotional relationship to hunger, and I don't know what it's from. I've never been hungry in my life, other than, you know, my mother tells me the first few weeks of my life I seem to have trouble, you know, latching on or keeping food down. But I don't know, I grew up in South Africa the first 10 years of my life, and I think just seeing the inequity of that culture under apartheid created some of this. The legacy I would want to leave is, you know, that no one is hungry on the planet. And yet I'm very much a part of the business world, you know, and of the capitalist world. And many of your listeners would probably feel like, well, those are at odds. You can't have both. You know, it's people like you who want to invest in these companies who are for profit and creating inequities of wealth that keep the hungry people starving. And I don't believe that as a general rule. There certainly are examples of it, very painful examples of it, you know, where people with money have taken terrible advantage of those without. But my belief is that if we use the financial system to both philanthropically and through microcredit and through investing in this very widespread interconnected way to use our capital to actually create self-sufficiency for people, they will end their own hunger. And I would love to be, it won't be my legacy, but I would love to be a part of that legacy in my lifetime.
Well, I think that you already are. Before we close up our show, I'm going to give you two specific examples of some friends of mine I know in the green space who are looking at their relationship to money and making big projects. And actually next week in our next episode, one of them is going to be on the show. So the first example is there's a new song out called Now Is the Time. You can go to pollination.org and learn about it. It was written by a man named Troy Lush, who's going to be on our show next week. And his dream is to have Now Is the Time be the next We Are the World for this new green movement. And in fact, Ralph Simons, who is associated with Al Gore's Live Earth Conference on July 7th, is actually looking for a song that's going to be the next We Are the World. And so Troy's hope is that that happens. He was at Digital Hollywood about 2 weeks ago here in LA and played the song and has had lots of people hear it. I believe the Dalai Lama he played it for. So it's definitely in action, and they have a whole choir around it. Troy's an amazing man. He lives in Solstice Grove up in Western Marin, which is a beautiful community center that's really, really green. We're not talking just, you know, oh, organic fabrics here and there, but they've got the compost pile and the houses and a sustainable, truly sustainable community. And so one of the things that I'd love you to incorporate in your kind of closing comments is how the investment that Troy needs to make in moving that song forward, how his relationship to money can be assisted in that process. So it's not like he has millions of dollars to go invest in the song. It's got to be sort of a grassroots movement. So that's situation A. And situation B is another friend of mine who I know a little bit better is in the process of starting a Costa Rica Eco Academy. And his vision is to take Socrates and Plato along with all the actual doing of organic farming and the back to the basics kind of on the ground activities, combine that in a retreat form for adults and for their children, and incorporate martial arts and yoga so that executives come there for a retreat and get all of that. And he's anticipating that in 5 to 10 years, the amount of connectivity that we'll be accustomed to because of the growing digital environment will actually need to unplug and go to Costa Rica to do that in a retreat form. That's his vision. A little bit different than Troy's, but what's similar between the two of them is specifically in the second example is that this man had an incident with money where he loaned $30,000 to his parents and it didn't get repaid on time and it was kind of messy. Tech guy kind of went into spiritual life. So a lot of the messaging that he has is, I don't have the money, or I don't have any money, or how am I going to get ahead? Or I'm doing a tech gig, you know, making 60 grand a year and I've got options and all I want is this dream. And if somebody would just give me 10 grand, everything would change and my whole world would be different and the vision would manifest. My sense is, although I haven't spoken to Troy about it directly, is that what's true for both of them is if they just had a certain amount of money, everything would be okay. And I'd love for you to wrap up our show today and take as much time as you wish in inspiring and giving both actions or activities for gentlemen like this or our listeners who are really making progress in the movement but are stuck because of their relationship to money.
Those are great, great, great examples. Wow, there's a lot to say. I think first, I just want to come back to your, you know, if I only had this, whether it's money or if we only had, you know, no more cars on the roads or if only, just that whole line of thinking is the mantra of the mind. I mean, that is what the mind does. Anyone who sat still for even half an hour, you know, in silence and paid attention to what the content of their thoughts are, that's every single thought that ever comes up is at one level, I want to change this, I want to change that, and then I'll be something. I'll suffer less, I'll be happier, you know, this person will be nicer to me. But you dig down deep enough, and at the bottom, it's always, I'll survive and be happy. And so to really inquire into that, really to inquire into the truth of it, first of all, and to know in these guys' case, and in my case, in everyone's case, that we can't know for sure. I mean, all we can know is that what is happening in this moment is happening, and that what has happened has happened. We can't know that if this song, Now is the Time, becomes the next We Are the World, that that'll be a good thing. It might, but it might not. And so there's a certain amount of surrender that I have found tremendously helps in getting big visions to manifest. I think the more we are kind of tight-fisted, white-knuckled, you know, gripped on the steering wheel about, I know how it's supposed to be, I'm going to make it happen with effort, will, and, you know, manipulation if I have to, the less likely it is to happen. Because first of all, most other human beings are not very attracted to that energy. It's kind of a repulsive energy. So if you just want to look at it very practically, these guys need to attract investors or partners, and you want to have an energy that is attractive to other human beings. So that's just getting out of the spiritual and into just sort of the psychodynamic of it or the interpersonal of it. But again, in my experience with building two businesses and with the philanthropy I've been involved in and just in seeing clients and the different ways different kinds of clients manifest things, I believe that it's that sort of underlying assumption of, you know, God's will, for lack of a better term. I mean, that's sort of an overly religious term, but just use the Byron Katie, you know, sort of languaging and questions of, can I absolutely know for certain that it's supposed to be the way my mind tells me it's supposed to be? And anyone who's honest in that inquiry will come to the place of, no, I can't know it, because, you know, I'm just a thought. I'm just a stream of thoughts. There's nothing, you know, really special about it. And then I think there's a let go. And that let go allows a lot of creativity to happen. As I said before, it allows other people to be more attracted to your vision. And so now I'll step more into my financial planning shoes, which is what my profession is in, and maybe the only thing I'm actually qualified to speak about, which is businesses do much, much better if they rely on other people's money. Even if one of your listeners has a $5 million trust fund and they want to open an eco retreat, you know, in some other country, I would advise them not to use their own money to fund the entire thing. And the reason is, when you rely on using other people's money, you have to get communal and you have to make sure that the business concept is well thought through, because other investors will ask you questions that you've neglected to ask yourself. And they will make you look at competition in a different light. They will make you look at barriers to entry for future competition. They will, you know, just on an environmental scale, they'll ask you questions about why are you going to construct this with straw bale? It should really be constructed with blah, blah, because that's less of an impact. So again, you know, the theme of this whole show has been, I'm into interconnectedness. And when you're trying to raise money for your project or your dream, be interconnected about it and invite other people's capital to help make the dream a reality for you. And so with the gentleman with Troy who wants the song, you know, to do very well, again, I wouldn't go and cut a demo of the song with my own money and my parents' money or whoever. I would, you know, do what you have to do at a bare minimum to have something to get other people attracted. But as soon as you can, start testing it out on people, and don't know how it's supposed to turn out. I haven't heard the song. I mean, he could, you know, if he plays the song for a bunch of people and it just doesn't really light things up in people, then it's not going to serve the planet for it to be the next We of the World. You know, there might be a better song. Okay. So just have that spirit, you know, and allow, you know, life to unfold as it unfolds, not as you think it should unfold.
And what about the second example with the Costa Rica Academy? Any homework assignments?
I mean, on a practical level, look at other business plans. You know, go to a spa industry conference or a hotel industry conference and learn what the metrics really are in that business. You know, what are average daily room rates? What are construction costs? How often do you have to remodel? I mean, the hotel industry is unbelievable. They like remodel the interior rooms every, I don't know, 5 years or something. It's really, really frequent and very capital intensive. So what's that going to look like in Eco Resort? Does that mean you just let yours become sort of antiquated and then competition will spring up and be more attractive? Or is there a form of refreshing and rejuvenating that one can do in an eco-sensitive way? So answering all those questions, knowing how to do the actual financial projections, it's all well and good to say we're going to have to unplug in order to be, you know, ecologically plugged in a few years, but will people actually do it and how much will they pay to do it? And are you flying them down on jets? And does that defeat the whole purpose of whatever you're doing in the resort or not? You know, again, I'm not just trying to play devil's advocate. I'm saying answer these questions, you know, ahead of time so that when you go to your best possible investor, they can tell you've thought through a lot of things. And the way you'll get these questions even posed is by inviting other people into the process sooner than later.
Thank you. I think that's really valuable information. Most of the circles that I've been in when I've been doing interviews that are LOHAS or green related, people have come together, just like you said, to create projects together. But there's been an investment of energy, but not necessarily an investment of lots of money. And that interconnectedness and circular feeling and love and yay and all that, I can understand now how getting a whole board of investors would be even more beneficial for the movement. So I love that from you. We're about to wrap up our show. For texts and transcripts of the show and other shows on the personallifemedia.com network, you are welcome to look at the episode page. You can go to personallifemedia.com. And next week, as I said, Troy Lush, who wrote this great
song. Listen to Living Dialogues, thought leaders in transforming ourselves and our global community with Duncan Campbell, visionary conversationalist, bringing you the best
I just want to give a real call out to all our listeners and say thank you. We were voted in the top 100 podcasts in iTunes during the second week of June 2007. And that's top 100 out of 85,000. So I appreciate your listening. And you can also check out my blog on Living Green, which is really just short descriptions of my predictions, one paragraph at a time, just giving you links to things that people send to me or that I find of interest, or snippets from an interview I've had with Al Gore or Jack Johnson, all sorts of stuff. So check that out. So Brent, before I let you go, first of all, thank you so much for all your time today. Can you give us a few of the exercises that are going to be coming out in your book in January of 2008 before we go? Would you give us a few samples?
Sure. I wasn't prepared for the question, so I'll have to just think on my feet for a minute. Many of the questions are specific to the archetypes, but you know, one that I would say is really quite universal is, what's your version of if only? You know, what's your personal utopian vision with money? And it might be that there is no financial system in the world, you know, that everything's barter and trade, or it might be that you've got $1 million, or it might be that, you know, but what's your kind of, if only this would happen, if only these changes would occur, if only my relationship to money looked like this, then I'd be happy, then I'd be fulfilled, then life would be good. And journal about that for a little while. Really, you know, let that kind of voice out, because my guess is that it's got a lot to do with, how to say this, with why you're not there, why you're not, that it's that craving, that sort of wanting mind grasping for something that's not already present, that is the very thing in the way of experiencing abundance and experiencing the flow that we actually, you know, yearn to experience right now in the present moment. So that's one. For most people, there's a wanting impulse that occurs. So for many people in America, it's about buying something. It's a pleasure seeking sort of, you know, spending impulse. And, you know, often people are saying, well, how do I can't change it. I mean, we've got to buy things living in this culture. And so it's gray. You can't just say, all right, moratorium on buying. But what I would say is in the next 24 hours, see if you can resist just one wanting impulse and then write about it. You know, what does it feel like to walk past the store after you've seen the thing that you really want to buy, or a contribution you want to make to a charity, or helping a friend in need, or just some wanting impulse, buying a latte? You know, it could be anything trivial or profound. But the more important thing is, what part of you, what's the inner experience of avoiding the wanting impulse? I interviewed about 24 spiritual and financial teachers and leaders for this book. And, you know, one of them said there'll actually be a wall of grief that you'll be aware of inside you. It may be very suppressed, but if you pay close attention, not following any wanting impulse brings up grief and fear and, you know, sort of a I might be annihilated kind of tremble, because that's all the wanting is. The mind exists to want to supposedly make us safe and secure and happy. And you want to be free of that, you've got to inquire into whether it's actually working or not.
Thank you so much, Brent. It was great to have you on the show today. And just a reminder that Living Green is all about effortless ecology for everyday people. And the reason we put that together is because when you get a sample into the attitudes and beliefs and behaviors of people who are living green, what I believe is that you naturally evolve just by listening and hearing and getting a deeper sense of intimacy. So, Brent, thank you for sharing that intimacy with you. And I'll definitely send our listeners to your episode page so that they can learn more about you and what you do. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun, and I've enjoyed your questions. They're different, and I can tell your listeners are different too. It's, you know, I think this group can make a huge, huge difference in the world, and I'm just trying to help folks have more fun along the way.
Sounds good. Thanks so much. Stay tuned next week. We put out episodes once every 7 days when you'll be listening to Troy Lush learning about eco-sustainable communities, green MBAs, and you'll get a quick listen to Now is the Time, and you can see what your thoughts are on that. Thanks again. My name is Meredith Medland, and you're listening to Living Green.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com. And now, please enjoy this entertaining clip, recyclable comedy, from our sponsor, Plenty Magazine, plentymag.com.
Welcome to the Audio History of the 21st Century, Chapter 7, Bottled Water. In the late 20th and early 21st century, that is to say 200 years ago, the industrialized world developed a mysterious penchant for purchasing their drinking water in tiny plastic bottles instead of just drinking out of the tap. It's not that tap water was necessarily foul. In most places in the United States, it was very clean indeed, sometimes held to higher standards than some bottled fluids. Nonetheless, people began buying cases of the stuff at their local Sam's Club and Costco, and swearing that they could taste some sort of difference. Professor Avril Michelson explains.
Professor, why did people in the 20th and 21st centuries start buying their water in little bottles?
I do not know. I am a professor of Spanish. ¿Por qué está usted en la oficina mía? That means, what are you doing at my office? Repita. ¿Por qué está usted en la oficina mía? The craze eventually depleted the source streams for the water, which is why Poland no longer has a spring. It also cost more energy to bottle the water and transport it on a truck than it did to shoot it into your home in a pipe. But most important of all, it resulted in many, many empty plastic bottles, which were eventually melted together to form Oshika, the world's only man-made continent, and the only landmass that does not erode.
Welcome to our island paradise. Please partake of our native cuisine. imported processed cheese.
And then, in the year 2042, the bottled water craze vanished as mysteriously as it first appeared. Now we no longer purchase water in little plastic bottles, though we do buy sunlight in large paper straws.
For more recyclable comedy, go to PlentyMag.com.